1460 WVOX.
Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard Garfunkel, and I'm the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can also be heard live streaming on WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110, but as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest this afternoon is author and speaker James Bradley, and our subject is his book, The Imperial Cruise, and how that cruise is that thought of that cruise is reshaping our view of Theodore Roosevelt. Welcome, James, to The Advocates.
Richard, thank you for having me. It's my honor.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you and talk to you. As I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on public policy issues. Public policy is therefore what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Over the years, the public policy of the United States has changed or been modified. On The Advocates, our show is most often devoted to that subject. James Bradley is the, by the way, is the fourth child of Iwo Jima flag raiser John Doc Bradley. He was raised in Wisconsin. Bradley studied at the University of Notre Dame, Sophia University in Tokyo, Japan, and graduated with a degree in East Asian history from the University of Wisconsin. He's had a vast experience in writing and producing corporate films and corporate meetings. He's traveled the world, living and working in more than 40 countries for nearly a decade. Bradley has run companies in the United States, Japan, and the United Kingdom, Germany, and Italy. He's jumped out of airplanes at 15,000 feet. I've had Doug Garr, my buddy on here, has done that 200 times. He scuba dove in deep waters worldwide, trekked to Mount Everest base camp, and walked among lions in Africa. He's an avid reader of history, enjoys discovering exotic cuisine, cliff diving, golfing, and snow skiing. He's been around. And basically, for the last 10 years, the James Bradley Peace Foundation and Youth for Understanding have sent American students to live with families overseas. Perhaps in the future, when we debate whether to fight it out or talk it out, one of these Americans might make a difference. He remains a professional, motivational speaker. He's the author of The Famous Flag of Our Fathers, where we met 10 years ago at Manhattanville College. He's written Flyboys and now The Imperial Cruise, and he's working on another book. He may tell us about it in a minute. He divides his time between his homes in Westchester County, our home here in Jamaica. When I had the opportunity, James, to read your latest book, The Imperial Cruise, I was pretty shocked at your characterization of Theodore Roosevelt and your indictment of American foreign policy from the late 1880s to the early part of the 20th century. By the way, who was on this cruise? What was it about, and why was it unique?
In 1905, President Theodore Roosevelt dispatched the largest diplomatic delegation to Asia in U.S. history. He packed a ship full of congressmen and senators, and they sailed from San Francisco to Hawaii, Japan, Philippines, China, Korea, and back to the United States. This cruise was led by Theodore Roosevelt's number two man, his assistant president, the Secretary of War, William Howard Taft, who would later be President Taft, succeeding Roosevelt. The mistress of the cruise was Alice Roosevelt, the virginal 21-year-old daughter of Theodore Roosevelt. They sailed in 1905 in the summer, and 100 years later to the month, I followed in their wake, and I also went from San Francisco to Hawaii, Japan, Philippines, China, Korea, and back. And I'll tell you, Richard, I was shocked at what I found.
So, in other words, you discovered something, and of course, we're going to go through it in this book, about a change in what happened with American foreign policy away from isolationists. In a sense, this was quite a departure from your earlier works, especially Flag of Our Fathers, which is about the flag raisers on Iwo Jima. Besides what you mentioned, what inspired you to go after this subject and be so frank with your assessments? Well, what brought you to that point?
Well, Richard, it was the same spirit that drove me to go to Iwo Jima to write Flags of Our Fathers and to Chichi Jima with former President Bush to write Flyboys, I was just looking for the historical truth. I thought Theodore Roosevelt, in all his power, dispatching the largest diplomatic delegation to Asia, something might have happened. And I was interested in World War II because my father raised the flag on Iwo Jima. My father came home and cried in his sleep for 4 years. My father could never talk about the horror, the massacre that was Iwo Jima. And I wondered why he was out there. And I was doing voluminous reading, over 350 books, searching for answers. And so much of history between Asia and America came back to 1905. And then here I find this huge diplomatic effort by Theodore Roosevelt, and I decided to follow in its wake.
You know, and just to reverse a bit, you know, a number of years ago I met Joe Rosenthal, who became famous for taking the most reproduced and dramatic photo of World War II. Of course, your father was in that photo as one of the flag raisers on the top of Mount Suribachi, which dominated almost all of Iwo Jima's landing area and the fleet anchorage. A lot of people think that ended the battle. It was only really mostly the beginning of the battle, the fourth day. So how did you become aware? You know, you write in Flag of the Fathers how your father suppressed this story. How did you become aware of his role? And why did you then feel it necessary to tell his story?
After my dad died in 1994, I telephoned my mom and I said, "Mom, I'd like to take down everything Dad told you about the Iwo Jima flag raising." She said this won't take very long because he only talked about it once on our first date. Wow. After he died, we found a letter that he wrote home from Iwo Jima 2 days after the flag raising. And it was a letter to his mom and dad in Appleton, Wisconsin. He was 22 years old. In that letter, he wrote, "I had a little to do with raising the American flag, and it was the happiest moment of my life. Richard, I cried when I read that letter, and I promised myself I would find out what happened on Iwo Jima and why didn't my dad talk about it."
Yeah. Well, you know, that inspires a lot of people, and I assume that the violence and mayhem that your father endured not only inspired you to seek out the roots of the Pacific Wars, which, of course, is covered in the Imperial Cruise, but what your father went through was indicative and reflective of many veterans, especially the Pacific War, who endured a tremendous amount of trauma, unlike the European theater, which was more in the tradition, not that it was any bargain. But
well, anytime you have a bullet near your head, you're in a bad situation. Iwo Jima was 110,000 American and Japanese cooped up on a 5-mile-long island. Underneath the feet of the Americans were 22,000 Japanese who had burrowed in 15 miles of tunnels connecting 1,500 killing rooms. So imagine you land on Iwo Jima, you have your rifle, and you can't see any humans.
Right.
They're below your feet. A Navy surgeon during the battle took a nap. He heard Japanese voices. He was startled because he couldn't see anybody, and then he pulled up the tarpaulin upon which he was sleeping and to his shock realized that he was atop a Japanese conference room where the soldiers were having a meeting.
Unbelievable. You know, in your latest book, The Imperial Cruise, you talk about a role in Cuba, Hawaii, and the Philippines. Getting back to Cuba, which is almost the nexus of our imperial foreign policy, why was it called the Splendid Little War, and who was the Dole family and the Haoles that moved, that were in Hawaii? What was the connection between Hawaii and Cuba?
Well, you can read a number of wonderful books for why we went to war in Cuba. The importance of Cuba in American history, 1898 invasion of Cuba, was how President William McKinley spun it to the American public, and it remains the way that America goes to war today. Mm. McKinley was a brilliant domestic politician. He did not want to go to war, and the young bucks underneath him, including Theodore Roosevelt, pushed us into war. And McKinley fretted. He cried. He needed drugs to go to sleep at night. His hands were shaking. He broke down and cried in front of friends about the war. But he was a brilliant domestic politician. He read all the newspapers, had his fingers on the pulse of America, and he knew that Americans would not stand for imperial war. Now, even though this was an imperial war, McKinley spun it as a war of benevolent intentions. Mm. America is going to help. The Cubans are being dominated and harassed and hurt and tortured by the Spanish. So the Americans are going to Cuba with benevolent intentions. And to this day, Americans send soldiers who are trained how to shoot. These American soldiers are trained how to kill, but Americans send them with the ideas and the imagery that they are going on with benevolent intentions. It was McKinley in Cuba that started this history of benevolent military interventions that continue today.
Now, of course, Hawaii was a little bit different. Hawaii had been discovered by Captain Cook. He had been there in the 1780s. By the time American missionaries went there in the 1830s, 90% of the population had died from one kind of infection or another. There was a tremendous importation of Asian laborers. There was the Dole family and the pineapple business. Who were these and who were the Haoles? And how did this connect to our American foreign policy, this idea of following the sun?
Well, Hawaii was obviously strategic because it's in the middle of the Pacific. And as you see in the book, congressmen and presidents had a long-term plan to dominate the Pacific and take Hawaii. Now, the job in Hawaii was not to kill off the natives like it was in Colorado or Utah or New York or every state in the country where we killed the Indians, because the Hawaiians were naturally declining. The job in Hawaii was to capture the land. The Hawaiian natives own the land. So American missionaries rejiggered the Constitution so that outsiders could buy in, and the Hawaiians got fooled. They had the carpet pulled out from underneath them, and all of a sudden, the missionary class, the planter class, the sugar barons who were offspring of the missionaries owned most of Hawaii. So we that's how Hawaii was conquered. And then when we basically ran the show, one day, the American ambassador to the separate country of Hawaii. Now, you have to remember, Hawaii is a kingdom. We're going back to 1893. It's a separate country. The Hawaiian palace, the Royal Palace in downtown Honolulu, was electrified and had indoor toilets before the White House in Washington. This was a separate country. The American ambassador to Hawaii marched United States Marines off a Navy ship in 1893, put bayonets up to the neck of the Queen, and invited her to leave the palace. That's how we took it over.
So now we come up to the Spanish-American War, and of course, the so-called sinking of the Maine.
Well, let's mix these things together for the timeline here,
Go
Richard.
Ahead. Sure.
That the young bucks in the McKinley administration want Cuba, but why? You have to take a geopolitical view of this and understand the value of Cuba. And we have to go to China. So China is a bowl of money. China is the largest population in the world. China is the perceived largest market in the world. Now, how are you going to get the riches of China into the East Coast of America? You need to build a sluice. You need to have an internet wire. You need to have some way to get the riches of China from Hong Kong, Canton, to America. So the idea was, wow, look at the Spanish Empire. The Spanish Empire is declining, and they have assets in the Pacific and the Caribbean. So we'll take the Philippines. We'll take Guam. Hawaii wasn't Spanish, but we'll connect that up to this sluice. And then we'll cut a canal through Panama and get the riches of China into the Caribbean. Now, in the Caribbean, we need some citadels that the Spanish just happened to own called Puerto Rico and Cuba. If we can put naval assets at Puerto Rico, Cuba, Hawaii, Guam, and the Philippines, presto chango, we can suck in the riches of China. That was the idea. That was the geopolitical motivation for these events.
Now, of course, just to bring us up to date here, Theodore Roosevelt is the Assistant Secretary of Navy at the time of this pushing to invade Cuba. And, of course, Cuban rebels were fighting the Spaniards for a year, and the Spaniards were actually ready to quit, in truth, many people feel. Theodore Roosevelt today is best known as the Rough Rider, hero of San Juan Hill, a man who went out in the West to build himself up. He became a progressive president. He was known for the bully pulpit and his policy of speak softly and carry a big stick. He goes to Cuba as a volunteer in this Rough Riders with Colonel Leonard Wood. He becomes a national hero. He gets placed on the ticket with William McKinley. McKinley is shot by Leon Zolkost, an assassin, and Theodore Roosevelt is thrust into the role of the presidency. And he has developed this view of that you articulate of Western civilization, the onward Christian soldier, in a sense. He now is the president, and he's looking at the Philippines, which has gone through a long civil war against us, led by Emiliano Aguinaldo. He sponsors this diplomatic cruise to the Pacific in 1905. Does your revelation of his foreign policy endeavor to tarnish his traditional reputation? Talk to me about...
No, sir. I didn't set out to tarnish anybody. What I set out to find was what happened on this cruise and what did Theodore Roosevelt agree with Asia. And if anybody thinks that the book tarnishes Theodore Roosevelt, then they don't like what Theodore Roosevelt stands for, because the book has 40 pages of notes. It's his words. And we see things. Maybe you're referring, Richard, to the fact that the truth that comes out in the Imperial Cruise might tarnish the shiny baloney image that he helped create in photo studios, and by editing all his papers and writing posterity letters. I mean, there was a false imagery with Theodore Roosevelt, but me tarnishing him, no. His words are his testament. The key here is that Theodore Roosevelt, we must honor him for the wonderful things he did. For example, if you go to Mount Yosemite, if you go to Yosemite Park, you've got to honor Theodore Roosevelt for his caring for our natural resources. We have to realize that he was a great trust buster, and there's so many positives about Theodore Roosevelt. I did not write a book about Theodore Roosevelt. I wrote a book about 1905 American attitudes towards Asia and what happened later because of those attitudes. And we see that although Theodore Roosevelt knew Yosemite, he did not know Mount Fuji. Mm. Theodore Roosevelt dealt with China, Japan, Philippines, not out of experience. He traveled in Egypt. He traveled in Germany. He could speak French. He knew Europe. He knew Eastern culture. This is 1905 America. It's an East Coast Eurocentric culture. We can't blame him for not understanding Asia. Now, what I show in the book is as president, he thought he comprehended Asia. As president, he thought he really knew his stuff, but it was racial theory through which he looked at Asia. He looked through thick glasses that were racially tinted, came up with a bunch of cockamamie ideas for how he could help rejigger Asia, and then he died. And what he helped put in place was key to why my father was later called from the snowy hills of northern Wisconsin to go out there to that little hill of Mount Suribachi on the island of Iwo Jima.
So you describe in this voyage, call it the Voyage of the Damned, you know, as a movie about that came out in the 1960s with Vivian Lee. The question of this voyage that goes, trace it a bit, and in the 2 minutes before our break, trace it a little bit where the stops were and who the voyage dealt with.
They got on a train. This is a huge delegation of senators, congressmen, Alice Roosevelt, Taft. They get on a train in Washington. They go cross-country through Chicago, out west. Alice Roosevelt is shooting telephone poles with her pistol. They go to San Francisco pre-1906 fire. And then they sail to Honolulu, Tokyo. They wend their way through Japan. They go down to the Philippines, go to all the different islands by different boats. Then they're over to Hong Kong, Canton, up to Korea, back to Japan, and home to San Francisco.
Now, let me ask you a question. How were they welcomed in Tokyo? It wasn't Alice Roosevelt like the media star of that era?
Delirious. She was the Jackie Kennedy of her day. Millions of Japanese turned out to say, Banzai to Alice Roosevelt. Banzai, the traditional cheer of 10,000 years of health by the Japanese. Because the Japanese knew that her father was going to help them invade Asia.
Now, she's connected with another Ohio scion of a family, Nicholas Longworth. And, of course, the Tafts were from Ohio, very famous to it. What was her connection with Nicholas Longworth?
Nicholas Longworth was her boyfriend. Nick was 34 years old. She was 21. Nick was a famous womanizer, but to Theodore Roosevelt, that didn't matter. What mattered to him was that Nicholas Longworth was also a Harvard man and a member of the pork club there.
In other words, Porcellian as the one of the secret societies that dominated the high Ivy League.
So Teddy wrote to the king of Germany, Nick is a pork man, you know.
So in other words, basically, this is an effort of fact-finding for these 27 congressmen and senators. This is the largest group ever to leave the United States on a diplomatic mission. Would you say it was successful in terms of information gathering?
It was a disaster. The Americans looked at themselves convinced that they knew what all these countries were about. They learned almost nothing. They were insulting to their hosts, and it turned out to be the seeds that were strewn to start World War II in Asia.
You know, we're coming up against a commercial break. I want to remind our audience they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 and live streaming on WVOX.com. I'm Richard Garfunkel, and my guest is author James Bradley, and we're talking about the roots of the American foreign policy in the Pacific that would emerge in the mid-20th century. When we come back after a break, I'm going to ask him the following question. With your evaluation of this diplomatic effort, Will our historical thinking with regards to the rise of Japanese imperialism and aggression change, and why? We'll be back in a minute or so.
When you get overheated this summer, cool down with us.
Completely refreshing and so delicious.
AM 1460
WVOX. This is Fox News Alert. I'm Lori London. Will he stay or will he go? General Stanley McChrystal has met with the president.
The general had his FaceTime with the president and then did an about-face. The general leaving the White House after the half-hour meeting. We're not sure what that means, but he had been expected to attend a meeting on Afghanistan that's now underway, and he was not seen returning.
Fox Radio's Mike Makowicz at the White House. The meeting on the war with his national security team. Many of the people McChrystal and his staff disparaged.
There's some rather blunt comments in a Rolling Stone interview. Remarks the president said
showed poor judgment.
We expect the president to make an address later today on the general's fate.
And there are mixed feelings on whether McChrystal should go.
We'd be losing ground and it would hurt our war effort in Afghanistan if Stan McChrystal goes.
Retired General Tim Hake, but many say if McChrystal doesn't have confidence in his boss, he should step down. Military officials say McChrystal was prepared to submit his resignation. This is a Fox News Alert.
A lot of people sell office equipment, copy and fax machines. Some of the technology they're peddling is superb, and some of it is not so stellar, I'm afraid. Thus, the dealer you buy from is just as important, you know, as the brand you select. Since 1972, the most respected, reliable dealer has been Vista Business Products. George and Bob Forstbauer's Vista, number one authorized Canon dealer in the tri-state area. They're the oldest and most established. So for the very best up-to-the-minute technology in copying, document management, rely on Vista, the newest technology from the oldest dealer. Westchester headquarters in Elmsford off 287 and 119. Call George or Bob Forsbauer, their sons George Jr., Bob Jr. There's even a daughter, Christine, in the family business. Vista Business Products, and Canon.
Call 914-347-7888 or visit us on the web at www.vistacanon.com.
Dry cleaning. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I have a real thing about this, and I've been telling you for years that when it comes to custom quality dry cleaning, you know, where you get your clothes back in perfect shape without that awful chemical cleaning smell, there's only really one dry cleaner that I know of in all of Westchester you can always count on. Scott Solomon Solo Clean. It's on the Post Road in Mamaroneck, New York. So if you want your valuable clothes returned in like new, pristine condition without that awful commercial cleaning smell, please try Solo Clean. The cost for their professional custom handling is really, incidentally, really the same you're probably paying right now. Solo Clean in Mamaroneck, New York on the Post Road. They're the best dry cleaner in Westchester. I'll go up against anybody on that claim.
Forecast Westchester County of the city for this afternoon. We'll see hazy sunshine, continued hot, humid. Highs will climb into the lower 90s. Partly cloudy, continued muggy through the overnight. Slight chance of a thunderstorm, lows lower 70s. Partly sunny, could be thunderstorm, breezy weather on Thursday. Continued hot and humid, highs up near 90. Mostly sunny, a bit less humid, lower 80s on Friday. Saturday's weather, plenty of sunshine, lower 80s, a bit more humid with more scattered storms Sunday. I'm Steve Palladary, Jr., reporting for WVOXW VIP Worldwide.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates. And before the break, I asked my guest, James Bradley, author of Flag of Our Fathers, about his father, John Doc Bradley, who was one of the flag raisers on Mount Suribachi, Iwo Jima, and his interesting and provocative book, The Imperial Cruise. James, with your evaluation of this diplomatic effort we were talking about, this incredible cruise of 27 congressmen and senators, Secretary of War William Howard Taft, Alice Roosevelt, who later becomes Alice Roosevelt Longworth, Nicholas Longworth, it's almost like a Lady Gaga event when she goes somewhere. Will our historical thinking with regards to the rise of Japanese imperialism and aggression change, and why?
Well, when Theodore Roosevelt looked at American foreign policy, the most important document was the Monroe Doctrine. Roosevelt authored the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, and kids are taught this in high school, that it was Roosevelt's way to project American power into the Caribbean and South America. But if you read his congressional address regarding the Roosevelt Corollary, he initiates the idea that America has police powers because America is more moral than other countries, and other countries can trust this international police power. He calls it international police power in this congressional document. Something that's overlooked by almost all school books is Roosevelt thought he could project American police power in two areas, the Caribbean and South America, south of the United States, and North Asia. This is the key. Roosevelt wanted to project a Monroe Doctrine into North Asia, but couldn't get Congress to provide the troops. So in secret meetings in the White House and also in Oyster Bay, New York, Roosevelt suggested to Japanese diplomats who conveyed this to Emperor Meiji that he would like Japan to have a Japanese Monroe Doctrine over Asia. It is this encouragement of a Japanese Monroe Doctrine that drove Japanese imperialism. And as you can see in the book, long after Roosevelt was dead in the 1930s, when the Japanese were moving into Manchuria, America was criticizing their moves. And they responded in Time magazine, hey, it was the late, great Theodore Roosevelt that came up with the idea of a Japanese Monroe Doctrine in Asia.
Mm. You know, the Japanese, so our audience understands, and I'm with James Bradley, Flag of Our Fathers fame, went from an isolated and feudal country in 1853, when it was opened, if you want to use that term, by Commodore Matthew Perry, to a regional power in 1905, when it basically took on the Russian empire and a world power in 1941. In between the defeated China in the 1894-95 and Russia, took by force Port Arthur, created an overseas empire by taking Formosa and Korea, and in less than 100 years, they destroyed our fleet at Pearl Harbor, conquered the Philippines, controlled Manchuria and a large part of eastern China and much of the Pacific. Were we initially responsible, and how did our secret agreements that you mentioned in 1905 later encourage Japan to do this?
Well, when Commodore Perry opened a feudal Japan in 1853, it was as if he was a cue ball hitting a bunch of pool balls on a table. And the pool table in that analogy is Asia, and the balls moving around are what happened after Japan moved west to emulate the United States. The Japanese saw the cannon on Perry's ships. As you see in the book, Perry says, I'm going to Japan to scare the bejeebers out of the Japanese with our industrialized war machine. And he continually threatened to bombard Japan unless they would knuckle under. And the Japanese, who were feudal at that point and had no industry of their own, realized it's eat or be eaten. So the Japanese strategy was, let's co-opt the West. Let's become like the West, even to the point where Emperor Meiji decreed a leave Asia strategy. In other words, the Japanese said to Theodore Roosevelt in America, hey, we're an island country separate from Asia. And Mr. Roosevelt, just as we're separate geographically, we're also separate culturally. And look at, we go to Harvard and look at our Brooks Brothers suits. We're stringing telegraph wire and building railroads. Nobody else in Asia is emulating America except Japan. And you can trust us to be your buddy in Asia.
Now, isn't it possible that Japan would have reached out to expand their empire without TR's encouragement?
Of course. The point here is, isn't it natural that the robber barons would have stolen all the money they could have on Wall Street during Theodore? Theodore Roosevelt stood up and stopped them. Isn't it possible that all the timber barons would have raped the landscape of America unless Theodore Roosevelt had stood up? And yes, the Japanese were going to expand into Asia. The key here that I reveal in my book is that they announced it to Theodore Roosevelt, who not only applauded and encouraged them, but agreed an unconstitutional secret treaty to encourage the Japanese expansionism and gave it a name, the Japanese Monroe Doctrine for Asia.
Now, Theodore Roosevelt seemed to promise the Japanese that he would make this announcement during his presidency. And he backs off this and later says that he will make this announcement in support of a Japanese Monroe Doctrine after he's president. And he doesn't do it. So what's your thinking on why he backed away from this? Did he start to sense that this was dangerous?
He sensed that the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine would not have a lot of life to it. America quickly abandoned the concept of being an official international policeman and embedding that concept in the Monroe Doctrine. So that idea went kaput.
Now, it's interesting, in this period of time, of course, a lot of history has gone forward. You talk a lot about the problems of the Philippines, of course, and the fact that William Howard Taft didn't feel too comfortable there when he visited and he went governor. Tell us something about this ongoing war that's sort of forgotten in the Philippines after the collapse of the Spanish Empire in the Pacific.
Well, Richard, there's two chapters on the Philippines in this book, The Imperial Cruise, and those two chapters took me 2 years to write, because if you go out and read 100 books on our involvement in the Philippines, they're so opaque and so confusing as to what exactly happened that I couldn't figure it out for a long time. But here's the simple story. The Philippines were seen as a key springboard to China. Remember that America needed the Spanish Empire in the Pacific and the Caribbean to bring the riches of China back. So from Hong Kong, we'll take the goods and the money from Hong Kong and go to the Philippines, then connect that up with Guam, Hawaii, cut a canal through the Isthmus of Panama, and then get Cuba and Puerto Rico and get those Chinese goods up to the east coast of America. That was the strategic plan. So we are fighting the Spanish Empire, who owns the Philippines. We show up and the Filipinos say, "This is fabulous. America stands for freedom and liberty. We are fighting against Spain for liberty." And just as the French came to help America in their American Revolution, just as Lafayette came to help George Washington, the Americans have come to help us, the Filipino people. And the Americans on the scene said, "Yeah, that's right. We have come to help you." And they let the Filipinos fight the Spanish into retreat, and at the last moment, the Americans on the scene said to the Spanish in a secret meeting, "Hey, how about you guys just surrender to us, and we'll take over and keep those Filipinos out of the game?" So to the shock of the Filipino freedom fighters, to the George Washingtons and John Adams of the Philippines, who were fighting for liberty, fighting for freedom, and thought that America was their ally, America slipped a quick one in the middle of the night and took over the Philippines from Spain, and the Filipino patriots now just had a new master, and they had no freedom, and they had no liberty, the ideals that America stood for. Now, what did the Filipinos do? They would do what George Washington would have done if somebody would have come here and co-opted the British. They fought on, and they fought on. That's called the Philippine Insurrection. Went on for years.
And finally, of course, the Spanish were bought off with $20 million as part of the treaty. And the Filipinos were basically Catholic, went to rule by the Protestants of the East Coast. We have to go to a short break. I want to remind our audience they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX. And we're live streaming on WVOX.com with my guest, James Bradley. And we'll be back in a minute or so.
Keeping you company while you're working hard.
Work, work, work.
AM 1460, WVOX, New Rochelle, and WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. The Gulf oil catastrophe claims two more lives in a collision involving a robotic submarine, the Gusher, now unchecked with the containment cap removed.
Some kind of a gas rising through the vent that carries the warm water down that prohibits hydrates from forming. Out of abundance of caution, the Discover Enterprise removed the containment cap with the riser pipe and moved away until they could assess the condition.
Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen, no word from the White House on the fate of General Stanley McChrystal's career following a private meeting with the president. The top U.S. commander in Afghanistan summoned to Washington following controversial published remarks by him and his staff. And the U.S. advances to the second round at the World Cup.
They needed just one goal, and they got it with seconds left on the clock. It was a white-knuckled game with fans screaming, cheering, and groaning, trying to urge their team on to a win.
And they did. One zip. Fox Radio's Courtney Keeley. Fox News. We report, you decide.
Now in Westchester, for corporate travel, executive transportation, and custom limousine service, the leader, clearly, is Excel. After two decades in the county, Rich Guberti's Excel Transportation Service does just that. Specializing in sedans, limos, and 14-passenger vans, Excel is the new class of the fleet and the Westchester leader in terms of cars, service, resources, and the quality of their Excel drivers. Most of the Golden Apple's blue-chip companies have, in fact, in recent years, switched to Excel for local transportation and city-to-city service to Washington, Albany, Baltimore, Hartford, Boston, and Philadelphia at rates even less than rail or air. And you can use them too for a trip into town, the airport, or any special occasion. Call President Rich Guberti at Excel Headquarters, EXCEL Transportation, 576-9797, 914-576-9797. These days in Westchester, the new car service leader, because Excel excels. 576-9797.
New Jersey blueberries. They're fresh, great to eat, and they're here. Blueberries are a great source of vitamin A and C, and they're just 41 calories for a half cup serving. Besides all that, blueberries are delicious, and New Jersey blueberries are simply the best. New Jersey blueberries are juicy and sweet, great in pies, muffins, pancakes, yogurt, ice cream, or just by themselves. Let your imagination decide how to enjoy New Jersey blueberries. Remember, Jersey Fresh blueberries only come around once a year, and they don't last very long. So buy them and enjoy them now. You can even freeze them and enjoy them later. Go to your favorite supermarket and get some Jersey Fresh blueberries. It's a summer fruit treat that doesn't last very long, but they're so good. New Jersey blueberries, sweet, juicy, and delicious. Enjoy them now while they last. Courtesy of the New Jersey Blueberry Grower.
Every minute of every day, somebody needs blood, and donors like you are the only source. There is no substitute. Sound Shore Medical Center asks that you consider giving the gift of life if you're in good health, at least 16 years old with parental consent, weigh at least 110 pounds, and pass physical and health history reviews prior to donating. For more information on donating or sponsoring a blood drive, please call Christina Robertson at 914-365-3649.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel and my guest, author James Bradley of The Imperial Cruise. We're talking about American foreign policy that led to very possibly Pearl Harbor. In fact, it did. And his father's effort and flag raising on Iwo Jima. And finally, the war culminates on Okinawa. Today, June 23rd, actually, is the day after organized land hostilities ended in the Pacific. The war didn't officially end to August 14th. There was continued bombing of Japan, strategic bombing. And, of course, the atomic bombs, and later the first VJ Day was August 14th, and finally the official signing on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Harbor was on September 2nd. That's what has inspired all this carnage, all this bloodletting, all this problems, and, of course, this led to the Communist Revolution in China, our involvement in Korea. And here we are back in 1905 with Theodore Roosevelt, and we're talking about the Imperial Cruise. You know, Frederick Jackson Turner made popular the term manifest destiny. In your book, The Imperial Cruise, you write about terms that are used like Aryan, sun followers, white Christian civilization, little brown brothers, and other derogatory and social and racial philosophy seemingly espoused by Theodore Roosevelt, who's believed that these terms were quite normal for the time and not offensive, and he's known as a progressive, we know. Doesn't this revelation of his language and characterization tarnish him in a way, James?
Maybe to some people, but what I did was saw how Roosevelt and Secretary of War Taft explained the holding on of the Philippines to the American public. Now, President Obama, let's say, gets on TV this afternoon, he must speak in a vernacular. He must speak in simple terms that Americans can understand. That's the job of the president. When Theodore Roosevelt had to address the idea, why are we still holding on to the Philippines? In other words, today we're in Afghanistan 7 years later. Back then, we were in the Philippines for 7 years by 1905. Theodore Roosevelt said it was because the Filipinos cannot handle independence. They cannot handle democracy. Americans, he said, have thousands of years of experience behind them regarding handling democracy, and the Filipinos don't. So it will take them generations of osmosis to gain these democratic values from Americans. Mm. Well, I didn't know what he was talking about, thousands of years of experience that Americans have when America was only 100 years old. I thought Roosevelt was referring to classical democracy in Rome or Greece or something. Right. Even that wasn't thousands of years ago. But I went back to Harvard in Columbia, where Roosevelt was educated, and I saw that what he was referring to by those thousands of years, and what every American could understand at their kitchen table when they read his words, and every senator could agree with in Congress, was thousands of years ago, the Aryan arose, and with the Aryan came democracy, and we are the inheritors of the Aryan tradition.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. This type of thinking that frames his desire and thoughts for supporting American imperialism and the domination of Asian markets seems to be in the wheelhouse of the typical American of that age. You know?
Of course. Yes, it was. When there were hearings in 1902, when Roosevelt first became president, as to American atrocities in the Philippines, General Arthur MacArthur, who was later father of General Douglas MacArthur, but this is back in 1902, General Arthur MacArthur goes before the Senate, and he's a little irritated that the senators don't really understand what we're doing in the Philippines. So he bottom lines it, Richard. General MacArthur, commander of the Philippines, says, hey, listen, the Aryans came from Europe. They raised cattle. They came across the Atlantic. And then we became a great Aryan nation. Now what you're seeing in the Philippines is the Aryan just going further west to Asia. Mm. So you see in the book that everybody was speaking in terms of this Aryan racial theory that Roosevelt was taught at home, that he learned the intellectual underpinnings at Harvard and was solidified at Columbia. Professor John Burgess at Columbia, if you go to the Columbia website, it says he was the father of political science.
Right.
So political science was coined and invented by John Burgess. Well, John Burgess rooted political science in racial theory. He told Roosevelt the American white Aryan must take over Asia because the Asians are not racially capable of generating democracy themselves.
So TR makes Japanese honorary Aryans. Hitler in the 1930s and the tripartite treaty with Japan makes them honorary Aryans. We hear the term Aryans, eugenics, that come from Joseph Chamberlain, you know, in this country. The study of phrenology, all this kind of racial theory emerges. And it's interesting how this has captivated the American people as, you know, God's people, you know, in the 19th century. You know, with the emergence of Japan in the late 20s, moving up the clock a bit, their disavowal of democracy, they did have a representative government at the time, their emergence as an aggressive power in Asia, and their invasion of Manchuria in 1931, you seem to be saying that there's a direct connection to TR's 1905 initiative.
Well, you say I seem to be saying.
Or are you
saying? I provide documentation.
Right.
I provide documentation that in 1905, in his own handwriting, President Theodore Roosevelt agreed a secret treaty with Japan to allow the Japanese military to take Korea. This is key. Right now, Richard, we sit in New York. If we want to conquer California, we're going to have to take New Jersey, the next door neighbor.
Right.
Japan's an island country. They had to get the Korean Peninsula to begin their military advance into Asia. Theodore Roosevelt knew this, and he granted them Korea in an unconstitutional agreement made through Secretary of War William Howard Taft in a secret meeting with Prime Minister Katsura in July of 1905 in downtown Tokyo with only a translator present. Taft then cabled Roosevelt this deal, which was unconstitutional, and Roosevelt secretly agrees to it, and the Japanese begin their conquest of Asia. The facts are there for everyone to see.
Now, you know, it's interesting that you, of course, chronicle draw the timeline about this relationship. Let's call it the Roosevelt sellout of the 2,000-year-old Kingdom of Korea. Didn't he promise Korea that he would be their big brother?
Yes, but just like so many Indian tribes where the federal government promised them protection, Roosevelt, using his racial lenses, saw Korea as just a dying race, as just a tribe that wasn't going to make it, and they were impotent in his valuation, whereas the Japanese were potent. Mm. And the potent countries, their job was to take over the impotent countries so that civilization could advance. So Roosevelt thought this was a great progressive experiment. You know, this encouragement of Japan to expand into Asia, we can't separate that from his progressive attitudes. He thought he was doing a wonderful thing.
Right.
This was not an underhanded, evil thing he thought he was doing. He thought he was doing this for the betterment of civilization.
So in a sense, this idea of democratization, which was the foundation of the Aryan, the Central Asian Aryans that goes to England, that comes to here with our political documents of John Locke and our other documents of the different philosophers of the 18th century, that seems to be an extension that T.R. wants to bring to the Pacific, because he looks at our future in the Pacific, not in Europe.
Right. He says the future of America is in the Pacific. And once again, he did not know much about Asia, had met few Asians. So he dealt with Asia with racial theory. The key theory was that China was an impotent race and was going to collapse like a big old barn.
Hmm.
The Aryans who were in London and Washington were going to pick up the pieces, but they couldn't get their troops into the area. So Roosevelt saw the Japanese as a helpful rent-an-army, an honorary Aryan. And the Japanese promised Roosevelt that they were more American than they were Asian.
Right.
And Roosevelt encouraged them to expand into Asia, which he thought would serve American interests.
Well, this divide-and-conquer policy that the United States uses Japan as the tip of the spear against Slavic Russia and backward China, the market, seems to backfire, as you articulate in your book. It's a tremendous read. I think anybody who's really interested in modern 20th century American history has to understand this and realize it. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I want to thank author James Bradley for joining me this afternoon. Thank you, James, for coming here. It was great to have you.
Fabulous to be here, Richard. My honor.
Thank you. He on The Advocates with WVOX and giving us a critical insight to how our current world was affected by diplomacy initiated by a cruise across the Pacific 105 years ago. Next week, The Advocates will have former Ambassador William VandenHeuvel. He's going to talk about FDR, the Four Freedoms Foundation, and its remarkable overseas work, and the new FDR Memorial in Roosevelt Island. If you want to hear this program and learn more about my guests and their work, you can listen to this broadcast, The Advocates, and all others, which are archived on my website, advocates-wvox.com. It's a warm day out there. Stay cool if you can. And thank you again, James, for being with us.